Blog Talk Radio.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for tuning in. If you're on the air with me tonight, this is Teresa Rayford. This is Black Power Radio. And I missed you last night. I've had technical difficulties with all of my technology over the last couple of months. So I had basically offline systems as far as the technology for the show. And I apologize for that. So I'm just glad that you're tuning in again. And I was looking at our stats from the other shows, and so I was very excited about that. So just wanted to talk about some things that are happening in the community and then go into this episode. And I do have my friend Tammy. She's going to be calling in again. And tonight's topic is America's education system a safe space for children of color? And the reason that we're going over that topic and the reason that we're asking people to call in and let us know, you know, like, what do you really know about core standards, or how do you feel about the new districting rules, or do you even understand what's happening in your schools, you know, in the schools within your district? We want to ask that question because we want to gauge the understanding of how critical politics play into this whole education system that we have in our communities that are mostly at risk and disadvantaged. And so, again, the question is America's education system a safe space for children of color? In September of this year, September 25th, a couple of members of the Don't Shoot Portland Committee went to the Portland Public Schools board meeting. And at that board meeting, we were listed on the agenda items as public comment, and we had the assistance of a document, a communication that we basically drew together based on some of the things that we've had to deal with parents as we've advocated for the education of their children for the last 5 years. There were some serious asks of the school board and of the district in regards to audits and oversight in regards to our children's education. We wanted to understand why the graduation rates were less than 50% for children of color in Portland Public Schools in the same year that the school district superintendent was getting a raise. We wanted to understand why there were contracts that were just direct negotiation contracts that didn't require certain terms that would be in within the legal standing of our Oregon constitutional business laws as it applies to contracting. So when we asked for the audit, the reason that we were doing that was because in the Black community, the systems are basically geared at the population and that demographics. And so if there's money going in, we want to see results that are better than 50% as far as our children graduating. And so asking for that is something that anybody would. And what we found out is that it had been a lot of ask, or there were different organizations or people that had been asking for audits, and at no time had that been something that was viewed to as a privilege. And so when we got that, or with the assistance of our communication that was basically articulating it in a language that was closer to legal and accounting than, you know, just me telling you on the phone or on the radio or in the board meeting on the record, it doesn't take much. It just takes you being engaged. So when we talk about community action plan and we talk about education committees, it's because that's something that is something that everybody in the community has to have a benefit in. So I'll see how long it takes to get my co-host on the line, and we'll just see what goes on. But if you want to answer that question tonight, is America's education system a safe place for children of color, please go ahead and call in. I'm here on the line with you, and we just want to see how you feel about that. And at the same time, also, how do you feel about Oregon under attack? I guess they're still out there. And, you know, we were on our Facebook page, and basically there was a posting that said that we were advocating towards violence. We were advocating violence against those guys because violence had been perpetrated on us as protesters. And I felt like it was indecent for people to think that or to say that just because we're calling out the basic and typical you know, misjustice or injustice or whatever you want to call it, as far as in response to people protesting or occupying. We already know, and everybody in the world knows, that it would be a different situation if those were people of color out there with guns. We know that it's a different situation when we have children at the mall walking outside with the toy guns that came from inside the mall. We know that it's a different situation when you have people inside Walmart, and it's a different situation when your 12-year-old is at the park and he happens to be a black boy. So let's not make it seem like we don't have that difference. But because we're bringing it up doesn't mean that that should be silenced, because we don't understand the entire land part, or we haven't picked a side in that fight, doesn't mean that the conversation that we're promoting is not necessary. It's something we should be talking about. You know, it's something that should be discussed, and it's basically the best benefit that we have of the whole Bundy issue that's happening in Oregon under attack. If this issue can give us something to talk about that can be changed by influencing policy and lawmakers, then let's talk about it. Let's put it on the table. Let's get it out there. It's an election season. You know, let's force that issue. Let's do something about it. So if you can at all costs, you know, change your own hashtag, but keep the conversation out there. I haven't read any of those articles, but I'm going to take the tagline and use them to educate people in a way of, let's make this discussion worthy, let's make it productive. So do the same. We all have networks. We all have people. I got a caller here. Let me see who this is. Hey, caller, are you there?
Yeah, how are you doing?
Okay, hey. So, caller, where are you calling from?
Portland, Oregon.
Okay, cool. So how do you feel about the education system? Did you hear that question about do we feel like children of color are safe in the education system?
Yes, and I definitely don't think that they are. I live in North Portland, and I definitely see a lot of problem with the children of color and the police and how they're treated at a young age with this school-to-prison pipeline. We had an incident with a couple kids at a bar that I was working at, where they came in and they were doing some stuff in the bathroom, and we kicked them out, and there was some physical altercations outside. But when the police showed up and talked to us, they were trying to charge them with rioting and felonies and all kinds of stuff, and I was like, whoa, I got punched in the face once. I mean, that wasn't the first time I'd ever gotten punched in the face before, but, you know, rioting for a 16-year-old kid, I just thought that was ridiculous. That was ridiculous policy that was even, you know.
Yeah, so what did you do as the victim in that situation, you know, and in regards to the whole policing situation?
Like, well, I gave a statement, but I think what I really in turn did was I kept ignoring the Rod Underhill's office kept calling me, the district attorney that was trying to prosecute them. And I just kept ignoring them and blowing them off until finally I answered a phone, I answered a call one day from a random number, one of those 503 numbers, and it turned out to be one of those kids' lawyers. And I just gave him a real short statement. I said, look, I see what they're doing. They're trying to charge them with rioting and this and that and felonies under the age of 16. So these are kids. Like, come on. Like, why are we going to do that to them? And the lawyer didn't know what to say to me. He sat there silent, and he goes, well, thank you, and you have a great day. And I got information that that specific kid was let off. And I believe that was right. I mean, it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah. Well, right on, man. Well, thanks, you know, for doing that. I consider it a community service. So those were school-age kids, and they already had an engagement situation. I know that if they're out there in North Portland, it's likely that they go to Roosevelt. And I know they had a video out there about the policing situation with Roosevelt, and it wasn't too favorable. So were they already turned up before the police got involved in this situation? Like turned up, or did it just turn up more?
I believe that honestly, I remember hearing that they were related, like they had older siblings that were, you know, involved in what they call gang activity, but what they were trying to call those kids gangs. That was a group of five kids. That's not a gang. That's a group of kids. Who knows if they're even really, like, they just happen to be together that night. Who knows if they're together every day like that.
Exactly.
I mean, this label as a gang, really? Like,
yeah, because I'm always bringing up issues with the mentoring of the police officers in the schools and with our attorney general running a profiling task force and trying to figure out what that actually looks like. I'm thinking that we need to be looking at some of the contract applications and some of the relationships we have with the Portland Police Bureau and other law enforcement agencies as it pertains to our children's education. Because when you're in the education system, there's a lot of applications and things that come across that you agree to. And I think in some points, when we have that much access, that is bypassing the whole issue with profiling and taking the officer directly into an opportunity for investigation. And if we're looking at officers coming to the scene where, you know, they're talking about, like these guys are related to this person, that person, well, that means you have a prior investigation and you already know who this person is. And so that person is indeed a suspect rather than just somebody that is a complainant or a defendant, you know. Like you've already capitalized on knowing their life history in order to dictate your directive and, you know, the absolute outcome of their justice in the way that it's given to them. Because the language counts, right?
Oh, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am, that was exactly what it was, labeling them as a gang. I mean, that leads to so many other things just by that one little word, those labels, you know? It's terrible. I mean, I think that's inhumane. I mean, that's setting them up for failure further. I mean, once you're on probation at that age, I mean, you're 16. How much time do you have to fuck up still? I mean,
you can cuss on this show. I was going to ask you, like, what are some of the things that you think that schools can do, you know, like that are different, or what type of programming can be available within communities that could probably gear youth towards a different direction so that they're not out, like, committing problems like they did at the place where you work, or just doing different things that are considered loitering. I mean, standing at the bus stop in Portland is loitering if you're the wrong color, or the right color, you know what I'm saying, but in the wrong, ain't no wrong space. I don't even like getting that language out of my mouth, but basically if you're in a space where somebody that's a jerk decides that your color is an intentional opportunity for them to stop, then that's your thing. But, you know, like what things do you think could be available to you out in the community that looks like it could be, you know, feasible?
Well, what I would like to see in schools, especially in the middle school age, especially in inner cities, because I grew up in the inner cities and went to inner city schools too, this is like a need. You need to know how to speak to the police properly. You need to know to not be disrespectful for once, but you also need to know your rights. You need to know
so that you don't have to talk to them if you don't want to, and they don't consider
right.
it disrespectful.
I was never once
to me, disrespectful is not saying, you know, I can say I don't answer questions in a respectful way, and they should respect that. They shouldn't think that's being disrespectful. And
that's
the culture
true.
Here is that if you don't comply, you're being disrespectful. And
anywhere.
No. If you don't comply, based on their training, they need to know the rules of engagement. They need to leave you the fuck alone. You know what I'm saying? Like,
right.
If I say I don't answer questions, then that means I don't answer questions. And at the point that I ask you, am I free to go, you say yes or no. If you say that I'm not free to go, well, put me under arrest because I've already asserted my right. You can tell me, okay, well, I'm placing you under arrest. And at that point, I'm not going to talk to you. When I get to the place where you're
right.
taking me, I'm calling my attorney at that point. Anything else, if you engage with me, you're harassing me. You know what I'm saying? You're basically verbally assaulting me if I've already asserted my right. You know, and you're arresting me too. I have a right to remain silent. I don't even have to tell you that.
Right. No.
And I might, if you ask me anything else, I'll say I have a right to remain silent. But I'm gonna say it respectful and considerate, and you don't hurt me because you know better, right?
But their policy is to, I mean, deal with people that way because they see it as disrespect. But it's really not in a disrespectful way. Safety. I mean, I am trying to prevent myself from harm because who knows what the hell.
Who, the person that they stop, that don't have the bulletproof belt
right,
on and
right.
400 pounds.
Right, and the, all the baton, the spray, the taser, the gun.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you got four different options off the top of my head. Handcuffs even hurt. I mean, you've got so many options. And you can call for backup. What am I going to do? Like, why, like, how are we such, I don't know, we, I can see people with guns and stuff being a threat, but when you really look at it, they have so much backup, and they signed up for this job for a reason, and
mm-hmm.
it's like a soldier. I mean, that's really what it is.
Yeah, they got a misconception of public safety and serve and protect. They feel like they're like the bodyguard of the rich, and that's what they're supposed to do is serve and protect people with money, and they need to stop that because all of us have rights.
I think I see the paradigm shift happening in our local city hall where some of the systems are more focused on the homeless and everything. I went to a Rotary Club meeting earlier today over at the Sentinel, and everybody in there was talking about the homeless issue, and I was happy that that was a point of focus. But at the same time, I know that it is because there's going to be some foundational systems that are going to have funding opportunities attached to them. So anybody that's in that realm of things as far as housing for youth and things of that sort, the conversation is getting those systems into the whole school system, you know, in a way that they're attainable. So we'll be able to help more as far as, like, I think in the next couple of years there will be more housing opportunities and more long-term goals for community planning within school systems instead of just the culturally specific.
Well, when it comes down to the homeless, I believe that we need more permanent housing is what we need. I mean, America has, what, enough, like, six houses for each homeless person? That's,
well, sustainable transition is going to lead to,
it's true.
You know.
But, or even tiny houses, those are cheap and effective. Like, but we just continue to, I mean, I don't know what we're doing. I really don't know what we're doing. Like, Portland and Seattle, what I've noticed of the Northwest is I like to hang out with all the street kids and all the, you know, I find joy in those people. You know, that's, I don't know, those are my kind of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found that there's this thing called Greyhound Therapy where people who are homeless in Fargo, North Dakota, or Sioux Falls, wherever, those cities buy them Greyhound bus tickets to Seattle or Portland, generally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we get them from Vegas and everything. There's
they get them from everywhere.
That get them. They get them through the medical system, too. I think there's some fraud in there.
Well,
there's definitely fraud,
but they're sending people, they're just saying, hey, go here. They have the resources to help you, and the weather's nice.
Yeah.
So go up there. They'll help you. But what are we supposed to do once we have this overload and they continue to come? I mean, it just,
well, Portland,
you
really
see what's happening in Portland and Seattle if you're in those cities. We have such a, our,
well,
people,
some people still don't know that Portland is Portlandia and Portland is part of Oregon under attack. How do you feel about that whole situation, that whole Oregon under attack?
What are they occupying? a bird wildlife reservation? Why don't they, if you're going to occupy a federal building, go to the one in downtown Portland. Go to the one in wherever they're from.
Well, they're doing it because the land that the people were, like, basically, what do you call it, poaching?
But I thought
and
it was
burning,
in Oregon.
Arson and everything. It was in that same
state. I thought it was in Nevada, but I guess
no,
it's
no,
not.
No.
Oh, that's,
somebody came up from Nevada. The land is out here in Oregon in Burns, and the family lives in Burns, and
okay.
Two that were prosecuted were basically turned themselves.
Well,
in.
They're also defending a person who burned down our forest, like
a wildlife reserve.
Yeah, a wildlife reserve. It just,
no, like it was just trees and bushes and
they're
trees,
trying to say it's like
our
right wing occupy, but they could do better than that.
Occupy knows better than that. That's propaganda, and we got to remember.
Oh,
that.
I know that, but I'm just saying they can. They have done. I don't know. They're nuts. It's a different kind of situation. It's scary, though, because look at what happened with MOVE in Philadelphia. They dropped a bomb on them because they wouldn't leave. That was a family with children in there. These are a bunch of adults. I don't know what they're doing in there. It's, I don't know. It's interesting to me because you see how different they treat different races. With them being white, even, I mean, just, they're not getting bombs dropped on them. They're not even, like, the feds aren't really threatening them, or they're shouting at them, go home.
Well, there was an article in the Huffington Post where they said that they felt like they were getting it worse than the Black Lives Matter movement, that people were giving them more scrutiny and calling them terrorists and stuff. But I think they got to realize that the peaceful protesters showing up with bullhorns and banners and posters don't have guns. They have, like, legal observers and grandmas. You know what I'm saying? They got kids. So the police are coming with the guns and with the riot gear and all the wagons and grenades. But the people are generally coming, like, with signs. And so we're not the same. There's no fucking comparison there. Like, that's ignorant. You guys are in a park and you're still alive. This young man, Tamir, was in the park and in less than, you know, in 2 seconds, he was dead.
Well, also, think about Mayday. Even us. They've been occupying that place for how long? We were in Pioneer Square for 20 minutes before I got maced.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know what I mean? We get, I mean, all you have to say is Black Lives Matter. Oh, no, that's a threat. Like, saying that.
Yeah, and actually tomorrow at the City of Portland building on the second floor in the auditorium, there's going to be a citizens review committee meeting with the internal affairs and all the city attorneys and the police bureau and all those guys to talk about the kettling incident that happened November 29th, I think it was, of 2014, in honor of Mike Brown. It was, you know, it was a protest after a rally at the Justice Center where they flashbanged us and basically kettled us. And if you don't know what kettling is, it's when the police wrap around you and basically do not allow you to continue to protest. Like, they shut down our protest right around 10, you know, well, close to 11 o'clock, and I guess it was because of a shift change. That was what one of the early news articles came out with. The, you know, guy on duty was talking about, yeah, it was probably shift change and he wanted to go home. Based on the Constitution, like, it's not for them to choose when the protest is over. It's up for the protesters. And so one of the many, and I would hope that other people would appeal, because the reason that there's even an appeal process available, and in regards to appeal, let me just go back. Anybody that files the claim with the independent police review when we had the rally or even after that probably got a letter that said that your claim was rejected. If you got the rejected claim, basically what that means is that because of the Department of Justice settlement, there's now a mechanism in place that allows the Citizen Review Committee to reevaluate your claim. Now, what has happened is that people didn't file appeals, and I think that people didn't file appeals because either they just felt like, you know, they didn't have a clear understanding that that was an option, and maybe we can talk to the Independent Police Review about that so that they can send out a clear correspondence. Or that they didn't receive the correspondence. That's not a lost cause. Danielle Holloway will be there tomorrow. She filed an appeal a couple of months ago. And I also advised a couple other people to do the same thing. But we had a meeting last year with the Citizens Review Committee, and it sounds like it's really going to be a good situation. So if people can come there and support, or if you were involved in a kettle or know somebody that was involved in a kettle, it would be a great opportunity for you to come there. If you're lawyers or anybody in the legal industry, school or whatever, it probably would be very interesting to see this process and to be a part of it. It is good for historical content and experience. And so, again, that's going to be at the City of Portland building, the one with the big old giant Portlandia statue on it, on the second floor in the auditorium, and it's at 5 o'clock. Very long meeting, though, so I'll kind of be there. Limited seating, but they will bring in more chairs if necessary. And if you can, to the stop profiling, the end profiling meetings, it's the same place where we were at when the Attorney General and the board that's the task force writing the rules of engagement around stop profiling. Again, callers, go ahead and call in. The number is 516-666-9826. You can get a call in, and we can talk about if America's education system
is a safe space for children of color. And Tammy, if you're listening, you can call in at any time now. I know you probably want me to email you back, but I told you I have limited access. So hit me up. Again, 516-666-9826. And if you haven't saved the date, January 17th, 2016, meet us at Peninsula Park at 1 o'clock. We're going to have a rally, and then we're marching over to Bethel AME Church on 8th and Jared. So we'll be taking the same route. Rosa Parks from Peninsula Park, we'll take Rosa Parks, and then we'll take Martin Luther King straight to the church. And I'm not going to put the full situation online, but you guys know the route. So be there at 1 o'clock. All organizations, agencies, grassroots activists, everybody's welcome. Human Rights and Dignity, point two. Last year was Loretta Ray, and she was basically the host and MC, along with Marcus Cooper and Glenn Waco and DeAndre. And this year, Loretta is going to be leading again, and so she'll bring her own posse, and we'll be able to create history together. We have lots of agencies that are going to be out there with us. Whole bunch of kids, welcome. Just come on out, kids. It's a safe, family-friendly, exciting day. And if you haven't seen it, go to the Don't Shoot Portland page on Facebook, and there's a picture of Dr. King with his hands up, and that is our event page. And so you can join us that day, and it's going to be pretty cool. We have some special surprises for you, and there will be some youth leadership awards, and we will be announcing the nominees pretty soon for you guys. So just tune in for that, January 17th, 1 p.m. All right, did you have any other things that you wanted to that you might want to bring up in reference to the Black Lives Matter movement or anything that you've experienced from your end of the scope? We had a police officer call the other night from Georgia, and he had a super different view than what we, you know, because he's a police officer, and he's a Black police officer, and he's in Georgia.
Oh, so that's
so he had extremely complex, you know, perceptions and thoughts on different things. And so are there any subject matters that have been on your mind that you wanted to bring up and fill it?
Well, I'm trying to think of one. Sorry.
No, it's gone. Everybody got something to do.
Yeah, right. Well, I see you got a lot of haters online and shit. can you tell me something about that?
No, you're not the interviewer. What have you seen? I mean, well, we don't. I mean,
right.
I don't. I don't like getting messy. I'm not into that. But I mean, if you wanted to talk about, like, I don't know. I'm not going to talk about haterism. That's like, I think it's spam.
It's
I think
fair.
That when people are basically putting negative things out there and spending their time to do it, that really they're not focused on what they should be doing. And a lot of times it's just spam. It's a distraction from what needs to be done. I think everybody's a fed, so that's nothing if they're saying that I'm violent because I use cuss words and call people fed. you know, you're in this situation where you're
calling
getting
people out.
There's
nothing wrong with calling people out.
Well, I say it to them a lot. You know, I don't say it. Everybody says it, and it's nothing. But I usually am one of those people that'll, like, listen to everybody talk shit, and then when I see them, then I'll have something basically to say. And even when I know I'm really, like, trusting, you know, like, contain yourself, be cool, but it's I can't help myself. It's like, come on, let's have integrity and talk about things. And even if there's an interruption, it's still like I need to understand what's happening because I don't like being uncomfortable. But now we can talk about the complexities of foundational structures. I know that when I went to Chicago, that a lot of the discrepancies within the movement, and I think this happens in all movements, was focused on opportunity. We're programmed and born into an imperialistic system, right? We talk about colonialization and things of that sort. And so the structure that we're used to, that we're educated in and everything else,
is already something that they're teaching us and programming us on how to use. So even when we say we want to escape it, a lot of times if you've educated yourself through that system, that's the way you're gonna try to use your master's tools to escape his hand. But you can't. You have to fall into that structure. And so what happens is people that are, like, let's say on a higher economic scale, that are like the do-gooders or whatever, they have that complexity of programming. They've been privy to a direct blueprint that tells them this is the way that you apply these issues, and this is
right.
The system that's built up for you to deal with them. Someone of a stature that is not that complex would say, I know how to survive, and this is the way to do things. And it might be more empathetic, but at the same time, the return on investment, the sustainability, if properly nurtured, will be more foundational and stronger, and it'll evolve because it's built on a people aspect. You know, it's built on developmental things, not just hurry up and go or come and go, or, you know, it's built on come in here and let's build this relationship, and you can always feel comfortable being here, so I've got to make you feel comfortable coming in, which means I've got to like what I'm doing, which means I was probably born into the necessity for that part of my community.
Exactly.
And so I was talking to someone else. I mean, like I said, I was at the Rotary Club earlier, and I was talking to someone about the structure of the business relationship and how you have to have different systems that are designed. In places of poverty, when the government system is the only one that provides all the services, the little bit that they trickle out, it's not enough for sustainability. That's why we fight. That's why there's complexities. That's why there's the colonialization. They'll get to whatever is comfortable. People
well,
won't try
to that has
thing.
To do with capitalism, doesn't it? Because I've noticed that a lot of these like organizations, like
they'll take away the freedom of speech. I've been told about this.
Well, right, exactly. Like a lot of these just different organizations that all are
well,
they all have the same common goal. You know, they all have the same common goal, but they're just different organizations. It's an effect of capitalism that they all want to be on top of each other. It's always
the organization is built on its capability,
and it's
not based on its dream. You get organized once you can bring operational systems to your dream. You dream first, then you bring in operations, then you best practice that. You go out there and you do that shit and you make it work, and then you say, boom, I know how to do what I'm doing. I have quantifiable values attached to it, which means the cost, the function, the outcome, and now I'm really ready to roll. And that's how you build sustainability. You don't just say, hey, I have an idea, and I'm going to use, you know, like federalism or grant funds or donations to think about it. You do it. Apply. If we say we're going to do, like, if we do a GoFundMe and say, I'm going to do it so that I can do Know Your Rights workshops, well, we've already done, like, tens of dozens of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? And we want to say that we want to organize community members. We've organized schools and clubs and community members. We've done community advocacy. We can get probably thousands
of Girl Scouts love us.
Everybody loves us. The kids knew us before we got there because of other systems that we're connected to where we're providing community advocacy. And community advocacy means getting somebody that's picking you up, buying you coffee, and you're going with them to do research to help them get through some meetings. Or through some court dates, or through some filings, or through some articulating the civil rights abuse, or just getting their child registered for some programming, or whatever it is, saving their home, getting into the hospital, applying for Medicare. You know, all of those different systems are super complex when you get told no. And that's why, like, me and my guy, we set up the business at Oregon Know Your Rights back in March, and I'm really trying to figure out how do I want to move that forward, because I think that most of the work that we've done, even though people are saying we're not this and we're not that, everything we do is because of Black Lives Matter.
Well,
and that's not that as an organization, but as something that we've said for the last 18 months, specifically.
You've meant it before it was
and was making it happen before. Like when my nephew was murdered, that's what my thing.
Trayvon,
when they called us to do, I mean, every Yoshani Vaughn, everybody that was murdered that I know that came to me directly has been able to find system access, even if they didn't have it before. There were people that came through my network directly to them, and then anytime they needed me, I would try to be there. They knew I was everywhere, like, here. That's why I'm trying to create a system where, you know, it might be 2 hours a night, or it might be, you know, 2 or 3 days a week, but it's not going to be 7 days a week like it was. because that wasn't functional for the people I'm trying to help. Yeah, I'm the only one on the line right now with, my colleague from North Portland. But I don't know how many people are listening. I'm just excited that the show, the other night we had like over 159 listeners from different parts of the country. The dude from Georgia kept calling in.
That's cool.
Yeah, we had somebody from like Virginia call in and stuff. So I don't know if it's more outside the West Coast than it is people in the West Coast. I know people from the West Coast.
It doesn't matter. You're getting information out there. You're getting your voice heard. Doesn't matter by who.
I want people to do things in their community. Like, just be powerful, because just know that your presence in a room where policy is being developed is like a big thing. That's like huge to these people. When they see you show up, it's like, oh, God, what do we need to do? You know, just like how they're threatened outside, they're threatened when you walk inside, and they don't have to be. You're coming in with solutions. You have the answers to the things that they need, but they got to hear it directly from you. The people that are speaking on your behalf don't understand how to articulate what you need directly, and we can't be afraid of these people we elect. They're elected officials. They're getting paid sometimes because of the work that we elected them or not to do, but if they're representatives, they work for you. And we just need to start being really functional about how we let them work for us. If you have a community where it's about to be an election season, find out what their platforms are. Find out what people are running for office in your community. Go to the state website, pull up their bios, print that stuff off, distribute it, put the links on your networks. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's your business.
Sure.
It doesn't matter what people are eating for lunch on Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Who's running for office in your neighborhood? Even if you say you're not political, that is political. Police brutality is political. People that are supporting corrupt police unions are going to be corrupt politicians. If they accept that money, oh, my God, you have not a chance. Know what the collective bargaining agreements look like. Understand those mandates and those directives. You know, contact your local police union or check out the campaignzero.com or .org that DeRay and all those guys are promoting. That would be in your best interest, because you can pull up your state and it has all the factuals and actuals about all of the programming designed around the union and its responsibility for public safety. In your state, it's about to be a really cool legislative session. I mean, I'm voting season, so what you need to do is check out if you have a governor's race, senator's races, Congress, all of that. Check out their stance. Push the issue as far as the Black Lives Matter issue on those top elected officials. Get them to make statements and things of that sort. You know, find out if those statements that they make are in your best interest. Do an audit ahead of time. Request it at a county commissioner's meeting or at a city council meeting. Just say, hey, I need an audit of your housing for people that are living in poverty or people in, you know, certain income brackets or certain colors or certain disabilities. But ask for audits and get them on the record so that they'll be made as public records. Because usually when systems are corrupt, if there's an audit that's being done, the people that run the systems currently will hurry up and try to cover their ass by clearing shit up and doing it right. And so even if you don't get the benefit of, oh, the community stepped up and got us accountable, they still will start getting their shit right. So start doing that. Like, you know, ask for accountability through audits and investigations. Make motherfuckers give you everything in writing so that you can be able to share that information with your community. And especially if it's regarding something that is dear to your safety, as far as, you know, your child's education or your health or age, you know, disability, whatever it is, you know, catch your neck.
Mm-hmm.
The system is run efficiently based on the process for business. And if you're going to be commodity, you better make sure that you're top quality.
Right.
You know, so. Have you ever been through, have you ever voted before? I know there's a lot of people that have never voted in elections.
The only time I've ever voted was for Obama.
Okay.
So I voted for president once, but no, I've never, honestly, I grew up in Texas and I never voted for mayor or anything like that. I do seem to like the current Dallas mayor, though. I've heard a couple of things I like out of him, but I don't know his complete story, to be honest with you, but... seems like we got a good one there this time.
He's kind of progressive, right?
He's been very, well, yeah, Dallas has become very progressive, actually. Dallas is going in a good direction. I like it. It's booming. and it's still cool though. Yeah, Dallas is beautiful. We were voted the number one skyline in the world. I mean,
yeah, they got the Ross Perot Museum down there in downtown.
They got everything downtown.
Nice. Yeah. How do you think the whole Black Lives Matter movement is going in Texas? Do you know about any of the things that are happening out there?
I tried to do my research on Black Lives Matter in Dallas, and I really could not find much. I found some stuff about SMU, and I know they've protested downtown before, and I know there's been some Black Panthers over near Fair Park, but there's really not a whole lot. But at the same time, I've seen the media try to oppress the whole issue and act like it doesn't exist. So I know there's a lot there that I'm not seeing. I'm not ignorant to that. So, but I do follow Black Lives Matter Austin on Facebook, and they're awesome. They seem to be doing really good. They go to the Capitol. They protest.
They live at the Capitol.
Yeah, they're awesome.
I love Austin's Capitol.
It's a few girls, but they rock.
I was going to say that one of the big issues is that different organizations have different names, so that's probably
true.
We have to follow hashtag.
Well, I kept trying with that, like, Hands Up and I Can't Breathe Dallas, and I don't know. I was looking at a lot of Justice for Mike Brown Dallas. There was just not much really. Well, it wasn't ever leading me to an organization name. I have the same problem looking at in Seattle.
Well, you know what? I think I'm telling you, like, our communication, when we have this Facebook page that have, like, you know, tens of thousands of people on it, that page went down, I think, in, like, October or November or something. And we have all of our communication, like, all the different groups of different communities throughout the state. Oh, my God. We had access to everybody. It was very strong communication. And our biggest partnership with all of the different organizations, and why we can say that we claim it, is because we live in Portland. We live in Oregon. And there's a lot of people here with a lot of money. And basically, as long as we stayed on the streets and kept these issues out there, we knew that we could keep monetary support on the ground level in those different regions. Even if we didn't have somebody out here dying, we knew that by getting in the streets and doing the nonviolent direct action and then following up with the community workshops and the educational platforms and all that other stuff, panels and whatever, we knew that we were providing a service to them that we couldn't directly provide through the Black community. You know, we can share the rage, we can share the passion, we can share the loss, but we didn't have the financial ability to sustain their protests, not in Baltimore, not in New York, not in St. Louis, but we had a community that could.
And so, exactly. By
connecting with that community and being on the ground and getting that news coverage and putting that issue out there, that's how we were able to help sustain. That's what you call solidarity. Solidarity might not be us getting out there. Solidarity might be us getting out there, you know, making sure that they have what they need. And that's still the point. You know,
that's
we're still in solidarity with Ferguson. You know, I'm trying to get Michael Hassel out here. I want to get him out here so we can do a big, you know, symposium on Kajimi Powell and what happened out there a couple of days after Mike Brown died, you know, and deal with the whole aspect of people being able to capture that video and getting it out there, like that Walter Scott video. Like, this is amazing that everybody has the foresight to not just duck and run, but to grab the video and to put it out there so that we could have this power, because had not we continuously got inspired, unfortunately, by death, it would have been very hard to make that work. So here's my other host on the line, so hold on real quick. Hello, Tammy?
What's up? Yes, ma'am.
Hey, how are you doing? Excuse me for not having actual communication in place for last night and everything, and, you know, I'm trying to fix that.
Yeah, I was trying to look it up online and I didn't see you on there last night, so I figured you didn't. That's not a good show. I was actually calling in because I had been trying to get in touch with you, because we're kind of having an education issue at the school, so I want to check in with you that we need to address that. We have a meeting coming up next week.
Okay, right on. And tonight's topic is America's education system a safe space for children of color? And that's the topic that we've been on tonight.
Okay. Well, Well, you know what? Because you know me, I don't really care. But I will. Let me just run by you the scenario that we have going on as of today. And mind you, we are now into 2016, and we are kind of dealing with a segregated system right now in my daughter's school in her classroom. I got emailed this weekend stating that the classrooms is two different classrooms in the Mandarin immersion program at King Elementary School, Martin Luther King Junior School. And so the administration decided they were going to rearrange the children in the two different classes. And what a parent pointed out to me, started emailing me saying, our classes are being segregated. So there's a white and an Asian class, and there's a black and Hispanic class. And so after I got that email, I'm like, okay, well, let me go back and check and see what the email from the teacher said. You know what I'm saying? Because I really hadn't paid attention that close when I sent the teacher's email. I just kind of glanced over because I'm still in vacation mode, you know?
You know, if they're segregating, I mean, one of them going to lose their funding.
Okay, so guess what? So as I look over there, then I do see that it is clearly where one group is Hispanic and black, and then the other class is white and Asian, and with a couple of black students in there. And then what the other parent pointed out is because she's a volunteer, she also helps out in the classroom, that she knows that the white and Asian group is the high achieving class, and the other one is a low achieving, struggling SPED class with ELL students in it.
Oh my God!
So regardless to whether, I mean, I guess from the district standpoint, is that they're trying to ability group, maybe to make it easier for the teachers to be able to provide instruction, because maybe they don't have enough experience with differentiating between, you know, high, medium, and low groups.
If they don't have
additional
instructors in the classroom, that's not helping the teacher, because the teacher has to develop two different curriculums if this is what's happening. So the point of even, they didn't have to do all this to provide another teacher in the classroom, but the fact is that they still need another teacher. You can't have one teacher dealing with, their union wouldn't advise that. I'm sure the teachers' union wouldn't say, yeah, this teacher is going to teach two different curriculums to two different sets of students, or are the classes at different times. Did they completely segregate them?
Well, what they do is they go to one, so like for the one group goes to English in the morning, and then they switch over to the Chinese in the afternoon. Whoever has Chinese in the morning, they switch over to English in the afternoon.
Wow.
You see what I'm saying? So it's two different teachers with two different classes, and they swap kids halfway through.
Wow, they did the unconstitutional thing without putting it
on
the record.
And so, but the thing about it is, even if you're saying that you're splitting it by ability group,
is one of them now going to be balanced out as an advanced placement class? And how do you get that? You keep them in classes.
Okay, so that's
teaching elitism. Oh, God, that's
But Tressa,
okay.
Listen, I ain't even got to the good part yet. So like I said, some of the parents started contacting me to let me know the classes are being segregated, right? Well, my baby just happened to be, because she's a high achiever, so she made the cut into the white and Asian class, because those are the high achievers. So she made it into that cut. So a parent contacted the school and complained about her white child being in this minority class, and so they swapped my baby with her baby.
So if it's supposed to
be based on ability, how can a parent say, you know what, I don't want my kid over in this classroom? So it's supposed to be that she felt that her baby would get bullied being in that class. Now, mind you, her baby's the only white child in a class full of whites and Hispanics. So she felt that her baby would get bullied in that class. So then they switch my baby over there and tell me in my email, it's record, that my baby can be a helper, that she gets to, this can be her time to be a leader, and she does such of a good job supporting struggling students and students who are having meltdowns. She does such of a good job. This will be a leadership role for her to model for the other students in the class the daily routines that they need to follow. So my daughter is basically being employed as an aide for the other kids. So what about my baby's academic growth?
Can't get a check.
If that's the case.
Can't get a check. Oh my God, that's out of line.
But that's what I'm saying. Can she get paid? But that's against child labor laws, right? That's against child labor laws. I'm like, somebody need to cut my baby a check if she's gonna be a personal aide.
Oh wee.
And what about her academic progress? What about her academic progress?
What about safe space for children? That is definitely not a safe space for her.
So we're supposed to be having a meeting.
Right out of line.
Oh. Yes, ma'am. And so we're supposed to be having a meeting because I said, you know what, we, you know, I don't want the parents emailing me privately. Let's put it out there. So I put the teacher and the administration, I put the superintendent on there and everything. And I said, look, some parents are coming to me with some concerns because you guys are redoing the class list, and it has an overwhelmingly appearance of segregation. So this needs to be addressed. And I want to know, what is your goal? What is the intended outcome of this? Because I'm not understanding how our kids are supposed to be benefiting from a segregated system, and they're already in a segregated school program because the Mandarin program is primarily whites and Asians, and the King Neighborhood School is predominantly Black and Hispanic. So we're already in a segregated program within a segregated school in a gentrified neighborhood, right? So how is this supposed to benefit my baby? How is this supposed to benefit our kids?
It's teaching them how to be a second-class citizen. It's teaching them how to have no pride in herself. It's self-defeating. Is basically telling her at an early age that you are a second-class citizen, and instead of you being in that class that you was excited about, you're going to be a helper, okay? And be thankful, because you're going to be the best helper ever. It's going to look good on your resume, girl. We're going to put you up the next time there's a job. Yeah, after Susie get it again. And that's why I keep telling my white ally homegirls, like, y'all got to give up some privilege because this is not right. Why would they do that to that baby? They start young, and then they wonder why they don't like school and why they act out. Come on, please. Adults, you know, let's stop asking what's wrong with the kids. Come on, have some decency. I hope we have teachers and administrators listening. I hope we have parents listening, you know?
Okay, but the other thing about that, Tressa, that I find funny is, so the parent went and made sure that her kid got moved into a better classroom by her standards, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then they were emailing me to get me upset about the situation, about the class being segregated. So I was the only one that spoke out, like, you know, we need to have a meeting. I was the one that presented the email to say, we need to have a meeting to discuss this amongst everybody. So let me go a little bit further. So I have a friend who works for a preschool program, whose son is also in the Mandarin. I called her and I said, did you look at the email from the teacher? And she said she didn't get an email from the teacher. Her kid is in the same class as my kid. So there was only so they were hand selecting who they sent the information to on top of that, which I feel that it was the parents that they felt might have an issue with it or parents that they felt was more involved with the school. So all the parents in the classrooms did not get noticed, only specific ones of us.
Maybe only the ones whose kids was in the program that got it moved up.
No, what I'm saying is if you have two classes that you're reassigning kids, you should be sending it out to all the parents because all the kids are being affected by this change.
You should. You should.
Don't just hand select a few of us.
We know the district ethics. We know the district ethics.
Right.
We need to call
everybody. Everybody
should be a group of parents that's ready to stand up, fight back. What's happening? I'm ready.
Meeting is next week.
Huh?
The meeting. We're having a meeting next week.
All right. I saw Paul Anthony today at the Rotary Club. I met with a very big foundation, a couple of foundation people,
and they want to help us out in a major way. And so education was the focal point on top of the community violence. And so let's see what can happen through community partnerships. We got to stay sovereign. We can't be dealing with other people, but we really need to make this move forward. So we need people that really want to do something, that are serious about community empowerment, which, you know, you have to understand what the issues are in order to do something about it. So I got what you just said, and so I got the gist of that, and I'm going to be ready at the meeting and everything else. But how do you, you know, like in the gist of it, this is one of the topics that you're really serious about. And, again, the question is America's education system a safe space for children of color? You know, we right now know what's happening over there is not safe. That's not a safe space. If we talk about even just activism culture, because they, you know, in the activism culture, all kinds of situations around you are making the space unsafe. And so you got to keep understanding that organizing and protest are two different things, you know, but in the school culture, it's the same effect. If she's around somebody that's abusive, whether it be a teacher or the system being used against her, which that seems to be what it is, that's a violation of her civil liberties. You know what I'm saying? I'd be talking right now to, you know, our education committee about drafting something or doing some research, but right before that meeting, because you might not need to go. You know, they know we play hardball. Oh, what's going on? Am I running out of time? Hey,
yep, you are.
I think my show is almost over.
Girl, I didn't know that. You were down to the wire. You probably got about 2 minutes left.
Okay, right on. Well, yeah, I was going to say that. How do you feel about America's education system as a safe space for children of color?
Not at all. They have declared a war on our children. And if our children make it through the school system, then the police going to get them afterwards. So, you know, either way,
what
you got somebody coming.
What do parents need to do right now? What do parents need to do right now?
They need to be aware. They need to be present, visible. They need to be up in the school. They need to be checking out what's going on. And you need to talk to your kids, because your kids give you more information than anything about what's going on.
Right on. And what's the next school board meeting? Do you know that?
I'm not for sure. I haven't seen it online. But
all right,
all
we'll have some dates tomorrow. Good night, and thank you.
School website. All right.
All right. We'll have that stuff tomorrow. Thank you, and good night.
Yeah, hit me back.
All right, I will. Bye.